outdoors, coming on the airwaves, coming your way.
Hey now, we're outside indoors, beat on a buck on a snowy day.
Hey now, we're inside outdoors, baiting a hook and anchors away.
Baiting a hook and anchors away.
Baiting a hook and anchors away.
Inside Outdoors is brought to you from the beautiful rolling hills, forests, and lakes of southern Indiana. Produced in Bloomington and brought to you live every Saturday morning at 7 a.m. right here on your local community radio station, WFHB. Inside Outdoors features hosts Don Jordan, Buddy Bill Moser, and Rich Reardon, and gives you everything you need to know about the outdoors surrounding our local community, our state, and around our nation. With fishing, hunting, local and national outdoor news, the environment, natural resources, safety, issues in our community, and just down-home family fun, our goal is to inspire how to be a good steward of our precious natural resources. You can call into our show at 812-323-1200 and ask a question or tell us what's on your mind. So sit right back, get a cup of coffee, journey with us into the lakes and woods, and find out what our natural resources have to offer. If you miss the show, you can listen online at WFHB.org. Just go to the public affairs listing, and you'll find a podcast of our show at Inside Outdoors. This is WFHB Bloomington, Indiana, volunteer-powered community radio at 91.3 FM for South Central Indiana, also 98.1 in Bloomington, 100.7 in Brown County, 106.3 in Ellettsville, and online at WFHB.org. All right, good morning, good morning. It is Inside Outdoors time here on Saturday. We're taping this on Wednesday, but it's a beautiful day. Loving the spring, and want to welcome a couple of people to the show. Of course, Alan Bronenberg. How you doing, Alan?
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Hope you're all well.
And we have a special guest today, all the way from England, and John Monahue. John, thanks for being here.
It's my absolute pleasure, and thanks for inviting me. Thank you.
Sure. Well, let me just start out the show with our basic, covering our basic stuff. We're back to a lake level of 538 here in Bloomington, Indiana at Lake Monroe, and temperature of 62.6, so it's looking like summer again, getting closer.
Yeah, it's interesting that actually is the case, because I'm looking out the window here and I can still see that little inlet over at the Fairfax Beach, and it's still underwater. Normally when we're at 538, that's not underwater over there, but I can look out there now and see that, you know, all the way out to the end, the bushes are like largely underwater over there.
Well, interesting.
A little less than they were a few days ago, admittedly, but I find it hard to believe we're actually at 538 today.
You know, actually I've seen some differing things here now that I'm looking at it. My regular temperature one says 54, but yeah. I'm guessing it's maybe a little warmer than that after all the warm weather we've had. But
I think so, at least in the upper layers.
I'd say somewhere between 55 and 60 right now.
Yeah,
and
I'd say so.
I'll see if I can find another one while we're talking here and see if I can come up with a better one. This other site might be old. I'm not sure. I'm going to look on the Corps of Engineers here. But John, tell us where you're from. We were just discussing it, but it leads us into some interesting discussion.
Well, I live in a little town called Syston, which is just on the northern outskirts of a city called Leicester in the Leicestershire. Leicester, you've just set the picture to me of the beautiful water that you can see. Well, one of our claims to fame in Leicester is that I think we are the furthest in England than you can be from any coastal area. We're right in the centre. Oh. On saying that, it's only a two-hour drive to the coast anyway, so nowhere's very big in England, obviously compared to the size of the US, of course. but that's... and not everybody understands where Leicester is until we won the Premier League football in 2015 and became world famous.
Well, I was going to say, then they'll know.
But for geographical reasons, everybody knows, has heard of Robin Hood, who came from Sherwood Forest in Nottingham. So We are about 21 miles as the crow flies from the centre of Nottingham south. But here again, Sherwood Forest was not actually Nottingham centre. That was another 10 or 15 miles north of Nottingham. But, as the myth goes, legend goes.
It's still a forest. Well, I see a lot of farmland around your area.
We are very, very blessed in the UK to have some fabulous coastlines and scenery. We've got rolling hills and valleys and lots of green area and lots of history, of course. The only thing that we don't always have the regularity is the weather, but we sell good Macs and umbrellas.
Yeah.
We close to a town called Melton Mowbray, which is Melton's claim to fame. It's the home of the traditional Melton Mowbray pork pie, which has to be made in the area to be classified as a traditional Melton pie. And home, of course, to, I think, pretty famous Stilton cheese.
Right. Yeah, we were talking about that. That's one of my favorites. But I think Alan was saying they just call it blue cheese here and then they pretend it's Stilton, but it's not. Much better.
I think it's the same if you go to France, you only can buy champagne from the Champagne region.
Right.
But you can buy sparkling wine from, we're good producers in the UK now, actually, and you can buy a Californian sparkling wine, can't you? So
sure.
It's just not allowed to be called champagne unless it's made in that area.
Right.
You know what's interesting about Europe is that so much of their local product has been, you know, they have that AOC or whatever the denotation is, that it's official and can only be produced and marketed, you know, from that area. America has not embraced that particular branding for some reason or another. Even bourbon, that has a very specific location for production and means of production, still really gets bastardized. A lot of things are just whiskey. A lot of things are just rye, but they get called bourbon here in America. And, you know, no one until recently, when the premium alcohol trend kind of took off in America, had ever really pushed that. But we don't really have, now Wisconsin will, use their Wisconsin cheese moniker, on the packages that they sell. But for the most part, we don't really have that specialty by region thing, and it's too bad. And I'm just not sure why or how that came about to denote these particular products as being special to that region and only being able to be called that. Stilton cheese, for instance.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how to answer that, apart from obviously we have a lot of history in the UK. So these traditions possibly go back to areas way, way back. I don't know if there's any sort of connection from that. But I know there's lots of areas in the UK, like I'm not really a drinker, but I do like a drink called cider, which is traditionally from the southwest area of Devon and Somerset and Cornwall. Which it was originally produced from apples, apple cider, of course, and made, I think, basically because a lot of the apples for that type of drink was actually produced in the Devon and the Somerset Devon region.
Yeah.
It's still a nice drink, and in the wrong hands can get you quite wobbly.
My own feeling about this is that, I'm absolutely sure that, you know, the lengthy history that England has and Europe has that we don't have is part of it. But I also think that, food is taken so much more seriously in Europe than it is here. I know it's probably going to get me in trouble with a lot of people, but if you've not been to Europe and not experience the seriousness of local cuisine by the people who serve it and make it, you might not understand how seriously food is taken over in the European countries.
Well, I understand that totally. And I think here again, I'll probably get in trouble this end of the water as well, which I always am. I think ourselves as a nation, we've been a little bit late with that. We've always been led by like European cuisine, obviously the French and the German and the sure. continental cuisine, which is big. But I'll make you smile now. This is a true British statistic I'm going to fire at you now, gentlemen. And for anybody who's listening, the most popular English dish, if I said to you, what is the most popular English dish, and I'm pretty certain I know what you're going to say.
I'd have to say fish and chips.
Fish and chips.
Yep. You can't say fish and chips. You're right, but I think it comes in a close second to a good Indian curry.
Ah, yeah.
Out of here.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah, because obviously we especially in Leicester where I live, and we've got it's very much a very multi-ethnic community in the centre particularly, and people get on well, and only just 10-minute drive from here, we have an area where we call it the Golden Mile, where there's a lot of Asian gold shops and their own like sort of shopping center, and you'll buy some of the finest food in Leicester, Indian food, anywhere outside of India.
Sure.
So that's a bit of a smile from the British public now, you know, what's something traditionally English? And one of my friends come over from Germany, and my good friend Bob Cheevers, who you know, Rich, sure. who's he has an addiction to Indian curry when we take him.
Oh boy!
My local restaurant even know him personally. So, and that's the first thing when he arrives. What would you like, Bob? I want to wash my hands, my face, and we're going down to the curry shop.
Yeah. Well, he did mention that. When I was talking to you, he said, well, maybe he'll have some curry for you.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes. And we never need any extra encouragement to take him or get a gang of people to go along as well. Yes, of course, we've got the traditional fish and chips, which is, you will have the burger and the fried chicken and things. It's great, really.
Yep.
It's great to have these.
The pork pie with a slice of Stilton and a big hunk of bread and a nice scotch on ice, sounds just fabulous. I'm just thinking about coming home to that every night and going, oh my God, that I could get used to that.
Well, I think the food derives from basic farming food.
Right,
sure.
The pork pie is a the different manufacturers in the Melton area have their own top secrets, so you can't know all the final ingredients in there. But that's a nice tradition, and they all have slightly different flavours. But they have this obviously pork mince ingredient, which is set into a pastry, which is quite a hard, crusty pastry.
Oh.
But you may have heard from the area of Cornwall, they do a thing called a Cornish pasty, which was a meal, what the guys in the field can come out of the field, they'll be perhaps muddies and whatever, but yeah. They've got the meal is wrapped up in this heavy-duty pastry with the filling of the meat and the sweet and the potatoes and whatever's inside it, carrots and onions. And then they can hold that with a, and eat the center of the pie.
Yeah.
And basically all the pie crust, I stand to be corrected, but I think the pie crust was technically was a just a receptacle to eat the, you know, to hold the main meal.
Exactly. It's like a vehicle to deliver the, you know, which is a brilliant idea, by the way.
Exactly. And to this day, very, very nice. And you say, you know, you can have your Cornish pasty with a drink of cider. And I did omit to tell you that some of the ciders they sell, it's just a rumor, but some of the ciders they sell, NASA have sent a few rockets to the moon using cider, but that's just a myth.
Right.
I'm sure they're more like grappa than they are apple cider. So.
But yeah, back to your pork pie, as you said, Alan. You're right. They did the thing called the ploughman's lunch, which we were, you know, sort of some fresh bread, a fresh cheese from the area, apple, bit of fruit, and a pint of beer or whatever it would be. You know, just normal, like me, just a working class boy, fodder basically.
I could eat that way every day, John.
I've been lucky to eat in some fancy restaurants around. I'm not a snob, and I'm certainly not a food snob. And I'll get shot again for saying this, but I'll say it. You can have all your fine dining and your nouveau cuisine and all that stuff, but a good old fashioned. We call them cobs in the area, which is like a round bread roll.
Yeah.
They have different names from different parts of the country, baps, cobs, you know, batches. And
sure.
So basically a good piece of fresh bread and cheese and perhaps a little bit of pickle and a drink on the side. What more do you want?
Yeah.
I don't know. Especially with the quality of the cheese. Look, in America, when you say that, you know, you're going to get some hard, waxy, yellowish piece of something that could be just as easily used as shoe leather called cheese. And it's got, you know, that cheesy flavor of a cracker, a snack cracker, rather than, you know, real cheese. And that, you know, I've always believed that's why that never caught on here in America, eating that way, a slice of bread, a big hunk of cheese, a big pickle, or an onion.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no one thinks to eat that way. And it certainly would be easier, probably better for you, and taste a lot better than a lot of the stuff we normally consume at lunchtime around here.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Yeah, I agree with that. But we have the same level of cheese is available here as well.
You do as well. Okay.
Yeah, you can buy the shoe leather and you know, buy it, try it, and walk it home. You can do all that. You know, so.
Well, I think one of the issues here is that everything is becoming more just, you know, you go to any city and you see the same kind of restaurant, you know, Wendy's or, you know what I mean, like fast food and this stuff. The lack of that particular touch, like Alan was saying, is sort of diminished. You know, there are really great stuff. I'm originally from New Jersey, and of course, you got the Italian food and you know, pizza and all that kind of stuff that is unique to that area. But you know, when you get around the country, it just sort of washes out, and then you know, people just don't seem to understand that each area could have some really amazing, amazing things to it. You know, like you were saying, the Wisconsin cheeses are really pretty amazing, and you know, everybody knows that they're good, but you end up just going to the store and getting your basic general things that you always get, and that's one of the problems I think with our society now. Everything's kind of whitewashed, you know.
The homogenization of our food culture is—it's been a sad, sad thing.
Well, there's a famous saying And we do forget it a lot. If it's not broken, don't fix it.
Right.
And I think some of the old-fashioned basic basic nutritious type of simple fare is, I don't think it's a lot better.
The farming around you, so is it, you know, Welch of, you know, certainly has their sheep that they're pretty proud of. Is it a cattle and hog operation on the average farm around you? Are there sheep as well? How does that work?
Well, where we are actually in the Midlands, we're pretty much blessed all the way around the county with you know, quite nice countryside.
Yeah.
So we do have a lot of arable farming, and also, yeah, so it's not unusual to see a field full of sheep, especially this time of year,
yeah,
and cattle, and there's lots of, actually, I don't know what the correct word is, but like a natural pig farm,
right,
where they have big fields, and the pigs have got their own free run of the field, and
right,
the pigsty. There's quite a lot of that.
Yeah.
And the other development, I'm 68 in a few weeks, so I'm not a young man anymore, but what we have noticed in the UK, getting back to your point of, we've always been about for wanting to try new things, and, you know, and I suppose when the English started first going to Spain for the holidays, paella, what's paella? I want fish and chips, you know, but
yeah,
paella is fish. No, but there's all that situation. But one thing which has and is developing in the UK, and which is lovely, obviously, except this COVID period, we do a lot of farms now are going back to the idea of doing their own produce farm,
yeah,
shops. And there's some, and we're very blessed in within the little area where I live, within 10 or 15 miles drive, you know, 10 or 15 minutes in the car, I could take you to two different farm shops every day, and you could have a really first class quality meal.
I bet.
And, you know, and a lot of it's very, very rustic, and so that is developing really, because obviously I think a lot of farmers are having to diversify as well, especially now there's going to be the change of attitude between here and Europe.
Yeah.
But, you know, I don't want to brag about the UK because it has its faults like everywhere else, but we do have some fabulous scenery, and then you get into Scotland and go chasing the malt if you want, and the fully grown haggis, which is often seen at this time of year, after the malt.
Yep.
But yeah, we've got fabulous countryside.
Well, it's interesting you mention that, because, you know, whenever I see those photographs of England, Scotland, I mean, it's just the green countryside with the rocks and the hills and forests, things like that. You've done an extraordinary job of keeping that, you know, especially being a much older civilization than ours. How does that come about? I assume that there's some fairly draconian zoning laws about what you can do with your land, and how that came about.
Excuse me. Yes, I'm not an authority on this. I'm just a musician, but we do have.
Who better? I mean,
we do have. Obviously, we have a big thing in the UK called the Forestry Commission, which controls, and all our forests are pretty well controlled, and, you know, replacement, replantation, and all business like that.
Right.
And we've got the, I'm trying to think of the word, you know, for a lot of the countryside are heritage sites. So if you live in an heritage site and you decided to want to go out and paint your cottage sky blue, pink. Well, that may not be quite allowed because you've got to sort of adhere to the country code, which I think is a lovely thing, really.
Right. Well, it's what allowed you to have such a beautiful country through centuries. I mean, it's necessary, really.
But on saying that, like, there is other parts of the world that they do spoil, with financial exploitation. But I don't really want to get into that. But
I understand.
But
What about fishing, hunting, where you are? I assume that like anywhere, there's lakes and reservoirs and streams and whatnot. How is hunting and fishing sustained and maintained in the UK?
Well, a lot of the areas are still owned by lords and ladies. A lot of land areas, so a lot of those have control. We did talk about Melton Mowbray, which is possibly, whether you like it or you don't, it's the capital, geographical capital for fox hunting. It's it's been traditional. That area is fox hunting land in the area around, and so there is still a few official stables, the hunt stables, with the horses and the dogs. And that's a bit of a contentious issue with a lot of the British people.
Yeah.
But and then a lot of the rivers are controlled by local authorities. So there's a lot of areas where you can fish and you can fish, but you have to buy a river license to fish in that area.
Of course.
We have an enormous amount of lakes which are governed by different people, and so you could go and do, I think there'd be some way you could go and do free fishing, or you would go and pay for a license to fish on that lake. And of course, a lot of the lake owners stock the lakes for fishing as well.
Sure.
Is
that part of the sustainability of these big estates? That it's a fabulous subject that I have a lot of interest in, about these big aristocratic estates with castles and 10,000 acres of land around them, and through the ages, the relatives have had a rough time holding on to that property, and they're doing things like hunts, fishes, tour of the castle, that type of thing, some selected timbering, is that what, are a lot of the lakes owned by estates like that? Are they private lakes, or does the government control those as well?
I think it's a mixture of all, all three of those, really. A lot of the big landowners own the lakes, but they're possibly, I'm not an authority on that. I'm just surmising that. But I think a lot of them perhaps would be probably rented out to like fishing groups or, and as you say, lots of these people with the big, lovely houses, and we do have a fair share of country mansions and opulence in beautiful old buildings. But it's like everything else, they're about to diversify now to bring in an income to keep the things maintained. It's okay having a lovely castle on the hill, but it's a lot of, and all the work that you have to have done on these, what we call listed buildings, have to be repaired by listed craftsmen.
Right.
Which is great, because that sustains and keeps a lot of traditional skills alive.
Which would be the only way those skills would ever survive, because modern building techniques would overtake whatever was done in the past very quickly, just on cost alone.
It's the classic, isn't it? If it's not broken, don't fix it. So let's stick to what we know and keep it going. Everything doesn't have to be modernized all the while, does it?
No, and what's interesting to me, always when I go to anywhere in Europe, England, you'll see houses that are 400 years old. I mean, homes that people live in, it's because they're stone. The walls are 2 inches thick, And the beams are still the beams that somebody cut 250 years ago out of oak trees that used to be there. You know, none of that exists in America. I'm quite sure there's no houses in America that are 400 years old. You'd probably be hard pressed to find a house that was 200 years old that didn't have you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars of repair work every few years. I mean, we just never built that way. But you did, and all of that still exists there.
Yeah, and it should be there. It should be kept, in my opinion.
Oh, we agree.
Because it's our heritage, and then it's something we can show off to people who want to care to come and visit the country, which is just fascinating for an American to come to Stratford upon Avon and look where Mr. Shakespeare and his team of followers lived. And and as much as it was so exciting for me when I went to New Orleans, you know, these things have all been there. You know, we've got one earth, we should share it, and should share it wisely and be responsible, in my opinion.
You know, with regard, let's talk about something that, you know, I think you really, you know, obviously have an interest in, and that's music. You know, that's probably why, I mean, New Orleans is an older city, but it's also one of the most musical cities in America. You probably had to notice that. What, you know, any more, the number of music venues in any given town in America, except for a few towns like Nashville, where it's all music, Memphis maybe, New Orleans, there's a lot of clubs there. New York, there's still a fair amount of live music clubs, but nowhere near what it used to be. Los Angeles, kind of the same thing. What is happening in England to sustain music? I mean, I assume that you have your fair share of live music clubs. I mean, obviously your opera and your symphonies are well attended and well supported there in England. But what for you as a musician is useful?
Well, you're right what you say about the operas and the symphonies and things, and a lot of those have pretty much secure backing from government level, you know, which is rightly so, because we shouldn't let that heritage die. But obviously, let's just put COVID aside, because that's obviously stopped everything at the moment. So let's not talk about that. We do have a tradition here again, I think, because obviously the age of the country. From the grassroots level, we have the lovely old thing like the Folk Club, you know, which derived from the guys who have been working in the field all day, you know, and they've got their pork pie and their slice of pickle and the glass of beer, and then they come and get together and sing songs around the campfire and folk clubs. So there's been that element of folk stuff, which is then derived into acoustic clubs, which there's still a lot of those about, which is good. And it's great for the grassroots musicians, for somewhere for them to go, because as musicians, you know, it's nice to play, it's nice to sing, but we need to play and sing to somebody. We need an audience. That's what we're fired to do. And you don't learn your trade or your apprenticeship. I don't think you can learn it through a book. You've got to get out there. It's a hands-on thing. It's a spiritual thing. Sure. It gets into your system and it's there forever. And it's so your apprenticeship never finishes. But obviously, with the COVID situation, a lot of places have shut down, and we have a lot of music in pubs as well. But then a lot of it over the last few years have died a little bit, because perhaps the internet in a way has been a good thing and it's been a bad thing, because now people expect to download a song off whatever it is, download channel, and not expect to pay for it.
Right.
And a majority of musicians don't expect to make a million. They don't all want to be, you know, Elton John, or they don't all want to become Elvis Presley. You know, lots of people just want to play for the love of it. But it's nice if you can get a little bit of financial recompense for all the effort you put into it.
Well, there's no doubt about that. That's been a problem I know with, you know, all artists, you know, forever. The internet, as you so rightly point out, has enhanced that to be a bigger problem probably than ever. But is there an infrastructure for, like, does someone coordinate these little venues with a group of musicians, or can you just go to a pub and say, hey, next Tuesday, a couple of guys and I'd like to come in and play. You know, what do you think?
Well, most depends on the pub, of course, because we have a lot of sporting pubs like you would do in America as well, you know, for the big bowl game or, you know, or whatever. A lot of people have come through a modern generation where they're not really used to an old-fashioned, what I term as live performer, who gets there, gets his guitar out the case and does it, and with no artificial aids. So there'd be a lot of landlords who would accept you to do that, but they wouldn't expect to pay it. You know, you'd have to play for free.
Right.
So there is other venues who do, where they'll do they'll give you a small fee or a percentage of the door, or you know, they'll do a go around with a hat. There's no really big guarantees on places like that.
Right.
And it's like Nashville, and when you do find places like that, you've got 25,000 people after the same gig.
Right. Yeah, I would think so.
But from my own personal point of view, I've run a music club for almost best part of 30 years now, encouraging people of all ages and all standards. And they don't have to be Eric Clapton, they don't have to be Pavarotti. You know, just people who want to come, and like-minded people who love music and want to share music. It's not a competition, because not everybody becomes a top-line professional, you know. But it doesn't stop you loving it. And if your 15-minute performance in front of the bathroom mirror is your Wembley Stadium or your Shea Stadium, well, so be it. And so there is venues for that. But here again, not so many as they did, because from my own personal point of view, I know the amount of effort it takes to put into these places, and invariably you have to hire a room. So there's this cost involved, and you don't always get that back.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. And, you know, it's, you know, one thing that they're, like you say, it's a music pleasure to sit in front of a mirror. It's a music pleasure for you. You know, just in, you know, my lifetime, I'm 69 years old. You know, music seemed to be a thread of everyday life. I mean, either it was radio, or you would go by somewhere where someone's playing music. You would go into a place to eat where music was being played. But there was a music pleasure that was a thread in all of our lives that just no longer seems to be there. I get that part of that's, in fact, you can take any music you want and plug your headphones into your phone and get whatever you want. But I don't think that's the same thing. You know, to hear everyone listening to something together as diners, or as someone walking down the sidewalk in a big city, you know, going by a store in a little town, you know, that seems to be lost. It doesn't seem to be part of my life anymore. And I know that it was when I was much younger. Have you found the same thing over there in where you live, John?
Well, I've played in, I think about... We often say I've played in, I don't know how many different type of orifices, because a lot of them, not always the performance stage. I've played in famous freezing sheep pens in the middle of winter, you know, everywhere. But I forgot the trail now, what I was going to say, but I was interviewing a consultant cardiologist, because I'm in process of doing a fundraising album for my hospital who saved me a couple of years ago, but that's another story. And he is also a musician. But this guy is like a top, as you said, he took himself very, very, very modestly. He did the electrical side of the heart.
Yeah.
So he classed himself as a good heart sparky, you know, repairman. Yeah. But he played music and he was really in admiration of what I'd done. Now, I've done this job because I wanted to do it, not because I've earned any money. I've earned a living, you know, but since I've been ill, I've not earned anything, but it doesn't stop your drive to do it.
Yep.
So, and I don't particularly want to, you know, have a mansion on the hill. I've got my little house we bought years ago and we're happy. And that's enough. Yep. That's all you want, and contentment. Yep. But we both agreed that, you know, music, we were talking about music back into medicine, bringing music back into hospitals, and particularly into music is so important. I can listen to a song when I listen to Gene Pitney sing 24 Hours from Tulsa. It instantly takes me back to when Kennedy got killed. And I've got different songs in my life which are anchor points, you know. Lovely memories, some not so nice memories, but so we were saying that the importance of music in medicine is phenomenal and totally not understood half the time, especially with now people with dementia and Alzheimer's. You can still connect with people through music. It's just a magic. And I said to him, as soon as I can get the opportunity, I want to go with my guitar and sit by somebody's bed and sing them a couple of songs by Bob Dylan or whatever.
Yeah.
And, and talk to them, or go into the local hospice and chat to people. Because most people, like he did, he's done this job as a top professional and very well revered consultant. But he still had the anchoring of, you know, he played a bit of music himself. He's played a track on this thing, but that was his, like, I wish I could have done that.
No, I it's a fascinating subject, music and health, and what little data, and I hate to use that word, but data is, you know, what is looked at, is all extremely positive and helpful for patients, almost no matter what is wrong with them.
Yeah,
And they get very little of it. And I've always, you know, I'm in the medical profession myself, and I've always, you know, deep down, kind of known that it was probably because there's no billing code for music. You know, nobody gets paid for it, so who's going to do it?
No.
You know.
Yeah.
And it's sad. It seems cynical, but I guarantee you, at its heart, that's the problem.
Hmm. Yeah. But I've been lucky to play in quite a lot of hospitals over the years, and not for money. You don't do that for money. And I've played for people in the last hours, which are sad, and it's not me that's tipped them over at the end. a friend of mine.
How lucky they were! How lucky those people were to have had you doing that.
Well, I did it just before the lockdown. A good friend of mine who was a doctor, who was a great blues singer, and we went to visit her in the hospital, and that was one of her last requests, would I go and take the guitar and just sing a few simple little songs. And it took no effort to do. I don't know what else I just felt so humbled that I was allowed to do it.
Yeah. Fabulous.
Well,
yeah.
One of the other things that I think is important is not necessarily, you know, we're talking about a hospital, but just the having music in your life is going to make your life longer. I mean, it's a healthy thing to do, just like anything, to enrich yourself with those, being able to calm down and be more meditative, and to me, music really brings out the spiritual nature of yourself, because you don't have to think. You're not thinking in words. You're just experiencing something, you know, like nature, you know. And so I really do feel that that's important. And you know, another thing we didn't really bring up is the history of music and its impact into our country here. I've got a good friend that lives in Donegal in Ireland. He's an Irish singer-songwriter, and you know, the fiddle and the and so many instruments and things have come here, you know, which has turned into bluegrass and many other sort of forms of music that we kind of think of as being American, but it really does have a lot of different roots, you know, Celtic music and Irish music and Scottish music, and it's very interesting to me the history that also sort of shows up in when you talk about people. Like in the potato famine, they left, they came to America and brought their instruments and brought their music, and it morphed into something different. And that's always really fascinating to me, too.
As we spoke about the different meals, you know, the pork pie
right.
in the field, the Cornish pasty, or, you know, the glass of bourbon, along with this morph together with the music. So, you know, I don't want to get into politics because I know you've had your problems recently and we've certainly got our problems. But
when did this start? Did I miss this?
But with respect, I don't want to get into politics. I don't understand it enough. But I think if we got more politicians who could play C, F and G and sing the odd song together, as opposed to arguing about what's in the bank, I think we'd be in a world which is a lot better off, personally. But that's only my sixpenneth of advice.
We'll go right along with you, John. We agree.
Well, I absolutely agree. Yeah. And another thing I want to bring up, we're running a little short on time here. We got about another 10 minutes.
Sorry for talking too much.
No, not at all. This has been really fun. John and I and my friend Bob Cheevers and another man named Dave Greaves, Bob and Dave has written some music, and we are in the process of putting together a record. And John's played on some music. And what I'm trying to get at is there's now, with technology, we can be thousands and thousands of miles away and be putting together interesting music. So there are some benefits to our day and age in that we can work together in different ways, and which I think is going to turn into something really fabulous as we look into the future here. And that's been really wonderful too. I mean, this record that we're doing is just fantastic. And it's so much fun to just realize that people have, you know, kind of brought their talents from different places, and you can do it fairly easily now. One of my pet peeves is also, you know, people have lost their audiophileness. In other words, listening on earbuds on your phone is just not going to give you the experience of a movie or a soundtrack or a good record, you know. And you put all this time in and work really hard at trying to make it sonically beautiful, and you go into a studio, and it takes a lot of effort and years of effort on everybody's parts. And people don't seem to recognize that as much with music or musicians, like how much work and time and money and things they've spent on it, you know. And it's one of the things that I do see in Europe is that if we come over there, we tend to be able to work a lot more and be appreciated. I think European audiences really appreciate live music and hold it very dear. We don't as much anymore, which is a real travesty.
I think that's happened in lots of countries, but here again, it's these little pockets, like my little music club. It's not it's not a big music club. You used to get between sort of 20 and 25 guys and gals turn up and they sing the song they've written that week or having a go at something. And it's not for any competition, nothing. It's just for the love of doing it.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, we do have a breed of new people now. Say, so the internet is fantastic in one way to help you produce this stuff and like this. We couldn't have had this lovely conversation without the internet.
Sure.
But, you know, these songs I'm producing with Bob and Martin in Germany and we're doing all together down the line. And when you listen to them, you know, you think it's all been done in the same room.
Sure.
But also the ear, of a lot of people now, they've got used to hearing so much produced stuff, they tend to forget about the roots of it all. So you can get all those instruments and we can polish and hone them and sound absolutely note perfect and we can sing perfectly in pitch. But Woody Guthrie, with his out of tune guitar sitting there on the back porch, I'll get the message over just as well.
Mm-hmm. Yes, indeed.
Well, and I argue about that with maybe not argue would be a bad word, but my son, who is a great engineer and mastering engineer, he uses things like auto-tune and things that you know, I understand why they're used, but at the same time, the humanness, the human feel of being able to make a mistake and not have it ironed out and fixed all the time, it's something about that really, it adds to the performance and adds to the way that you hear the music, and I enjoy that too. I don't really mind if there's a little bit of a mistake going on, you know.
No, you mustn't lose the heart or the honesty of it.
Right.
Yeah.
As I say, that's why I say back to the point of like Woody Guthrie, and you just sit there and, you know, the guitar's not quite in tune and it's not always quite a 12 bar. It could be an 11 and 3/4 bar or whatever. It doesn't matter. It's the spirit, it's the heart, the love, which the feel that comes in it. And so we should listen to all types of music and consume it all, in my opinion.
Right. Well, and as we're winding down to the end of the show, this has been very fascinating. We haven't talked much about the outdoors, but I wanted to ask you a question. No, I think our fans are probably getting ready to go out and make some meat pies this afternoon. I just want to ask you is, are you noticing, I'm sure you are, but are you noticing a difference in the climate? How has things changed in the UK? Because of course it's very much changed around here.
Yeah, yeah. We're getting more winds than we do. You know, my little house, our little house, I should say. We have some fields at the back of the garden, and it's not tornado wind like you boys get over there, but we notice it's generally getting a bit more windier. And also, if you have ever expect to hear an Englishman saying, we don't get quite so much rain as we used to do.
Yeah, wow.
We do notice that, yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And I think we do need to take, I don't think it's the likes of you and I, to be truthful, is it? I think, I don't want to say this out of turn, but I personally think we talk about all these illnesses and things, and there's only one pandemic in the world, and that pandemic name is greed. And if we could get out of this greed business, you know.
Yeah, we talk about it all the time. I mean,
we talk about it every week.
That's only for my own passion, you know.
We have a reservoir.
We're right with you, John.
We have.
I do have one interest, and that's regional dialects. Does everybody around you talk like you?
No, my English is pretty poor, to be truthful. My German friends speak better English than I, because I'm not an educated lad. I'm not an educated lad at all. I'm just a normal working class boy,
But you don't talk Cockney. You don't really.
Oh, no. But, you know, but I. But
even in America here, I go to the South and I can't understand what people are saying.
Well, we have the same here. I mean, if you go to Glasgow and get the wrong person, the Scottish don't understand anybody from Glasgow. and if you get a true Cockney, the English people won't. But it is a regional accent. We have an accent here. We have a big thing we say. You know, you say with in a fond way. You know, hello, my duck, how are you? You know,
hello, like, my duck.
Yeah, things like. So we've got little phrases and sayings like we do in the northeast of England. There's lots of different accents in the
UK. Yours are so clear. I mean, it's certainly not listening to a Cockney accent. I mean, you're very clear. And I just wondered if everybody around you there had a similar clear accent.
Well, I think on a personal note, they'll be better than me.
Right. Well, you know, and I think that there's, in the United States, you know, we just talked about this with food and other things, but regional accents have diminished, you know, with the internet and with more people getting to talk to more people from other parts of the country. You do notice a little difference. When I grew up, I grew up in like Sopranosville, you know, Paterson, New Jersey.
Oh, wow.
It's a lot different. It used to have a very, very strong accent, and it's still there, but it's not quite what it is. You know what I mean? It's just been homogenized a bit, and I think that's happened all over.
Yeah.
But the world is getting smaller and smaller, isn't it, now?
You know, sure is.
I remember, I was born in Leicester, but my mum came from Nottingham, you know, from Robin Hood land, which seemed a long way away then. And to go and see my grandfather on a Saturday morning, we had to be up early to catch the bus, and that took nearly 2 hours to get into the centre of Nottingham. And then by the time you got there, you had to turn around to come back. Yeah. Now I can jump in the car, and 25 minutes I'm parking in the centre of Nottingham.
Yeah.
You know, everywhere has got a little bit smaller now, hasn't it, with the motorways, autobahn, links, and you guys can fly here than everywhere because you have to do for the distance.
Yep.
So the world is becoming a smaller place as this conversation is, which is wonderful, and I'm pleased to be part of it.
Well, it's really been fun having you. We are running out of time. We just started our music for the last minute of the show, so I want to thank John Monahue coming all the way from the UK to Inside Outdoors to talk with us. I hope everyone gets out and makes a meat pie this evening. I really hope that I get to meet you in person sometime soon. It'd be fun to come over and try some of your Stilton and have a beer at the pub. So
the door is always open. We've always got a bed for you to sleep in, and I'm sure we can find somebody who sells some illicit whiskey somewhere.
All right. All right. Well, thank you so much, and that's it for us. We'll
Absolute
see you next
pleasure.
Week.
Thank you.
Thanks, Alan.
Thanks, guys.
Well, that's all we have time for today. Inside Outdoors comes to you from the beautiful rolling hills and green forests of southern Indiana. Thanks for listening. Inside Outdoors is brought to you each week on Saturday mornings at 7 a.m. right here on your local community radio station, WFHB. If you happen to miss the show, you can listen online at wfhb.org. Just go to the public affairs listing, and you'll find a podcast of our show.